All right, we're in CLR world again, and we're with... Who are you?
Sean Farkas. I'm the developer on CLR Security.
Nice. So CLR Security.
Yep.
Interesting.
Big topic.
Yeah, it's a pretty broad area.
So what exactly have you guys been up to? I mean, what's new in the next version? And also, what were some of the things you've corrected?
Yeah, we've done... it's more, what haven't we been up to before? We've rewritten... or updated almost everything. If you think about security from the runtime's perspective as being, you know, a combination of security policy, which is sort of what you're allowed to do, and security enforcement, which is making sure that you're only doing what you're allowed to do.
Yes.
We've had some pretty big updates on both halves of that in the V4 runtime.
Mm-hmm.
The most obvious one is going to be with policy. This is a lot of people run into problems with security policy in V2 where they... you know, you would run some code off of, say, a file share. You'd write an app locally, and you put it on a share for, you know, everyone in your company to use, and they'd run it, and you get a security exception. You say, oh, what the heck? This worked on my local machine. And it turned out that the V2 security policy said, you know, I only fully trust code that came off of a local machine. And if you're running off of a network, well, that doesn't work, right? You get less trust.
Mm.
Well, this doesn't really make a whole ton of sense, right? If you're not really buying much security here. If you had a native app, you know, instead of writing in C#, I wrote my tool in C++, it would work for everybody, right? So if you're trying to prevent someone from attacking your network, you can't do it at the CLR level because that person could simply just attack you by writing native code again, right? And what it did was it made it harder for people to use managed code to write these sorts of tools. In V3.5 SP1, we actually made a bit of a step towards making that easier. We've put in a change where if you run code, an .exe, directly off of a share, that .exe and every assembly next to it was fully trusted.
Hmm.
So for a lot of apps that worked, but it still was sort of this hybrid, not fully there solution. You see some people run into errors where, oh, my app loads assemblies from another network share, or it loads assemblies from maybe a localized directory as a subdirectory, and those all became partially trusted, so you still didn't have the full story there.
Interesting. Yeah.
So we look at that again in V4, and we say, well, how can we make this better? And one of the key observations here is, well, why is it the CLR? Well, what business does the CLR have sandboxing code, right? You've got sort of two areas where you want to be sandboxing. The first one is, you know, I'm something like an enterprise admin, and I want to say only these specific applications should be allowed to run on my machines.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's something that's done at the Windows level, right? You can say, you know, only Adobe Acrobat and Word and Visual Studio can run on my machines, and that works across, you know, whether or not those applications are native or managed, which is the right level to do that from an enterprise level. The CLR doesn't have a responsibility there. And that sort of solves the problem where you have native code that gets a different security policy than managed code, and if you wanted to attack it, you would just write native rather than managed, right?
Mm.
The other place where you really want sandboxing is in a hosted environment. Something like ASP.NET wants to say, oh, yeah, I've got these websites, but this one over here isn't, you know, shouldn't run with full trust. I don't want it to take over my machine. This is a medium trust website. Or something like SQL Server, where you have, you know, code in the database, and the DBA says, no, this stuff shouldn't run, you know, with control of the process. It should have only a small amount of permission. And again, the CLR doesn't feel like the right place to be making those policy decisions, right? What place does the CLR have saying to ASP.NET, well, I know you're said that, you know, the applications have this, but I'm the CLR. I'm going to say you have something else, right?
Sure.
So the push that we did in V4 is we said, with those two things in mind, let's try to put control in the hands of the host. ASP.NET's going to say to us, here are the permissions I want this website to run with, and we're going to say, good. Then you run with exactly those permissions. Or SQL Server, same way. We'll say, here are the permissions, and we'll say, fine, you run with those permissions. We're not going to come in and intersect, you know, previously we had enterprise, machine, and user policy levels, all of which were complicated trees of policy that you had to be a pretty advanced security user to even figure out what was going to come out of these, right? Mm. Even more problematic is, as a host, as ASP.NET, I cannot guarantee what the final grant set will be because it could change on every machine I'm deployed on.
Mm.
So the observation there was, well, let's make it so ASP.NET's in charge. Why should we not listen to them?
Exactly.
So that's basically exactly what we've done. We've overhauled the hosting APIs so that now they do exactly that. You create an app domain, and you say, here's the permissions that the app domain runs with, and here's the permissions the sandbox code in that domain runs with. There's no more complicated policy levels. There's no more, you know, intersecting and, you know, evaluating trees. It's just, here are the permissions.
Excellent. So you went for a simplified model.
It's much simpler. Now, this API actually existed in V2. We sort of introduced it there and gradually pushed people towards it. Click once, pick it up in V2,
okay,
for instance. But now it's the full-on, you know, policy model. If you actually try to use the old tree model in V4, mm-hmm, you're going to get an exception. It's going to say, hey, wait a minute. You're trying to go down the old complicated path. It's still there for legacy compatibility. You know, if you have a V2 app that was heavily invested in policy, we'll still let you flip a switch and say, okay, I really need to use this. But in general, we're moving more towards the host control model.
Interesting.
And then along with that, we say, well, you know, you just run an XE. That's sort of a default host, right? That's the CLR built-in host. Mm-hmm. In that case, that's the same thing as running an XE, a Windows XE, right? A native XE. The default host just says everything's full addressed. It doesn't matter where the assemblies are coming from. It doesn't play games like 3.5 does, or 3.5 SP1, where it says, oh, you know, only these specific assemblies are fully trusted off of the network. It's everything.
Interesting. So, I mean, on Windows, I mean, you mentioned Windows, for example, mm-hmm, the advent of UAC, you know, love it or hate it, it basically stipulates that everybody is a standard user, which essentially means if you're running untrusted code, you run it in the context of somebody who can't do damage to the system. So do you have a similar model, I mean, not a UAC and CLR, but what if I hand you some code to run? What's your default policy? Pretend like I don't really understand the policy.
So the default policy is going to be to run that fully trusted. And the thing that we came up with there is, again, that could have been native code. There's actually, it's really interesting. We went through with a lot of the architects who have been on the CLR since, you know, pre-V1 days. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that there's not a reliable way to detect if an assembly will never be able to run managed code. Right? If by just loading this assembly, it will not run managed code. Which is interesting, right? You would think that would be an easy thing to do, but there are so many ways to, you know, trick the system into doing things that simply running the XE is a trust decision in itself. If you give me code and I've run that code, it could have native code in it. It could be entirely native code for all I know. I'm making a trust decision there.
Okay.
Now, but what you say with the UAC is interesting, right? Because we sit on top of NT, right? So CLR security, one way to think of it is CLR says this code does or does not have permission to open a file, right? Now we say it's fully trusted if you just run the XE. So all code that you just run directly has permission to open a file. But that just means the CLR says you can. It doesn't mean that Windows says you can. Mm-hmm. So if you ask to open a file and CLR says, yeah, great, it goes to Windows, and Windows says, you know, hey, wait, this is a standard user. It can't open, you know, a Windows system file, right? Mm-hmm. So that will give you an access denied at the NT layer, just as if you were writing C++ code, mm-hmm, and the CLR will reject it again.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So, you know, what about, you know, inner app domain communication kind of things? Like, what have you guys done in that world? It's always been pretty stringent.
Yeah. So what we do when we cross app domain boundaries, there's no permission associated with that. If you can get code into another domain or get a reference to code into another domain, you can always cross the boundary, which is actually interesting from a writing secure libraries perspective. It means if you don't want partial trust code to be able to call into your domain, you cannot be handing it out references to Marshall by Ref objects in that domain. But what we do is if you're in on a thread that crosses domains and you need to do a security check, so I try to open a file, am I allowed to open this file? We walk the call stack. You know, in traditional CLR security, what we do is
absolutely,
you know,
of course. We've been waiting.
So if you've got a couple of app domains. And you've got a couple of methods in the domains. Plus main. Calls down foo. Comes down here and maybe calls bar. Which then tries to open a file. So the interesting thing, what we do when you think of normal CLR security, is we walk the call stack and make sure that everybody on the stack has permission to open the file. Right? So this file open will sort of walk and see bar and say, do you have permission to open the file? We'll say it does here. And then when you think of this, you know, and the standard explanation, generally there's only one app domain involved. So you would think the next step is to go check foo and see if it has it. But actually, the CLR notices that there's an app domain transition here. So instead of going directly up to foo, we check the app domain. Right? So if this is fully trusted, and this is fully trusted, But the app domain itself, all app domains have a grant set. If this is, say, running with internet, when we hit this app domain transition, we're going to say, oh, wait a minute, this app domain is running as an internet sandbox. That means it's not allowed to open the file. So even though all the code is fully trusted, it's running in a sandbox domain, and that request will fail.
Excellent. That's good. And that's been the case for a while.
That's been the case since V1. Now, an interesting thing with V1 is that the old domains, which used policy levels that we were talking about before, the sandbox, tended to actually almost always have an app domain grant set of full trust, because the app domain itself wasn't having the policy evaluated on it. It had evidence, and you had to sort of go out of your way to get the sandbox correctly. It was incredibly difficult to do. Mm. And this was one of the reasons we actually introduced the new hosting API in V2, was because we noticed most people were not sandboxing their domains correctly, and they were missing this check right here. With V2, that new API was introduced, which adds, or makes it easier to set up the sandbox on the app domain. And now with V4, it's really the only way to set up domains in the default world. So it's much easier to correctly set up your sandboxes.
Excellent. Now, of course, you mentioned hosting, and Chris Broom, you remember Chris?
I do.
Wrote, you know, the epic sort of,
yes,
you know,
pages
blog posts,
and pages of blogs.
Amazing,
yes,
stuff on,
yep,
hosting.
Yep.
And obviously there's a relationship between hosting and security. You've already touched on it.
Yep.
So can you dig a little bit into sort of how you've simplified the hosting model? I mean, have you, from a security perspective?
We have. And this is going back to just what I used to, what I was just saying.
Yeah.
In V1, so in V1 we had four policy levels, right? There was the user level, the machine level, and the enterprise level, which were all files on your local disk.
Okay.
And then every app domain had an app domain policy level. And what a host would do is it would spin up an app domain, and it would attach a policy level to that domain. That would say maybe code with... What policy levels do basically is they're a tree of code groups, and each code group has associated with it a membership condition. And then a grat set. You know, you can imagine a whole tree of these. And we just go through and we say, does the code match the membership condition? Right? If yes, then get the grat set, right? And then evaluate the children, and we union this all together. So you would have to, as a host, come up with some sort of complicated policy here, right? You would have to figure out exactly how to set up these trees such that your code was fully trusted, but the application code was sandboxed, right? And on top of that, you had to set this on the app domain before any code got loaded in the domain. It was a separate step from app domain creation. Mm. If any code loaded in the domain before this was set, that code was fully trusted, and you didn't have any recourse, right? You had to basically throw the domain away. And then, additionally, what I was just saying, where the app domains themselves, if you didn't specifically set evidence on those domains to evaluate, not against your policy, but against system policy, the sandbox, well, then that domain wouldn't be, you know, running as a proper sandbox itself.
Sure.
So this is like a mess, right? These things are difficult to reason about. They're difficult to set up. And there's so many traps that you fall into. You think you sandboxed, and you didn't actually sandbox. What we've done, the problem's there is... That's sort of negative testing, right? If you think you sandboxed and you're not sandboxed, you might not notice it unless you have tests that are written specifically to fail in a sandbox. If you just have positive tests, they're going to run and execute and succeed because there is no sandbox there, right?
Yeah.
You actually have to have the reverse test in place. So if you're not having a full test suite or you have a test hole, you might not even notice that you have a security hole in place.
Exactly.
So what we did, this is the simple sandboxing API is what we internally nicknamed this thing as we were developing it, and it's called homogeneous app domain.
Okay.
Is the, you know, official technical documentation name for this.
Interesting.
You do a create domain. I'll get into why it's homogeneous in a minute. One of the parameters is the permissions. And then another parameter is a list of strong names. This permission set, this is now set up when you create the domain, is going to be the grant set of both the domain and all the code loaded in that domain. Right, so you say, I want to run, ASP.NET says I want to run Medium Trust. Great. So it sets up a permission set of Medium Trust, the domain boundary is Medium Trust, and all of the assemblies that it loads into that domain are Medium Trust.
Mm.
Right. Now you run into problems, of course, because ASP.NET itself needs to be fully trusted. Right. So we allow them to supply a list of strong names, or it's an array of strong names, which say, well, these guys down here are fully trusted. And additionally, anything loaded out of the GAC. So your framework is still going to be fully trusted.
Sure.
Right? Yeah. The world doesn't work very well if MS Correlate is not a trusted assembly. So what this does now, it avoids the trap. I mentioned one of the traps earlier was if you didn't set the policy up on a domain before you loaded code into it, it wouldn't sandbox. Well, now you have to set it up when you create the domain. Right? There's no possible way you have code in here before that's set up. The CLR is taking care of it for you. Mm. Another trap was not having a domain sandbox. Well, we're taking care of that for you, too. Mm-hmm. And then there's just the difficulty of reasoning about the policy levels. Well, it turns out that you don't have to do that anymore. You just give us the permission set. You don't have to build this tree.
Okay.
But what it does do is it says, this is why we call this a homogeneous domain, all of the parse trust code has the same grant set. In the old model, you could have every assembly with a different grant set in the NAP domain. And as it turns out, we did a lot of analysis on this, and it becomes incredibly difficult to write code correctly in that model. From a library author's perspective, it's hard enough to write fully trusted code that might be attacked from partial trust, right? You have to harden all your inputs, you have to make sure all your outputs are, you know, correct and that you're doing the right demands. It's even harder to write partial trust code, which is possibly attacked by other partial trust code, right? If you have three trust levels in an app domain, you've got the full trust code, you've got some medium ground trust level and low trust code. It turned out that medium guy almost never was written with the thought that, well, I'm partially trusted, but I might be attacked by someone with even lower trust, mm-hmm. which leads to the risk that the lower trust level can, you know, it level itself up to the medium level.
Wow.
So what we said was that, you know, this sort of provided a lot of difficulty. It made it very difficult to reason about the domains. It made it very difficult to write secure libraries. You can imagine things like caching. WCF likes to cache a lot. Mm. And if you're going to cache some, you know, partial trust code calls you, and you go out on the network, it's expensive, you get a result back, the next time they call you, you may just want to return back the cache value. Well, if all the partial trust code is different, you can't do that, because it could have been medium trust code that called you the first time and lower trust code the second time, and now the lower trust code doesn't have access to that data that you've cached on behalf of the medium trust code.
Mm.
So even writing secure full trust libraries was very difficult in the face of multiple trust levels. So this is why we sort of settled on, you have one trust level, it's the level of the domain and everything in it, and it's homogeneous and it works much easier.
Excellent. Now let's also talk about, I remember back in the day, code access security.
Yep.
Remember that?
Yep.
Where you decorate your code. You know that very well. This is all based on that.
Yeah.
Okay, so it is. So, because the thing about that was it was so hard,
yes.
in some sense, to have to decorate each, this function can run in this trust or, whatever. It was kind of insane.
Yes.
And so now you've simplified that for as a developer. So I'm talking about the compositional aspect of writing code.
Right.
That's creating a domain. That's right. Great. But when I start generating my classes.
So that's one of the other big improvements that we worked on. That's getting more towards the enforcement side of things.
Uh-huh.
What we did in V2 is we introduced this thing called the security transparency model. Mm. And in V2, what it basically acted as was a good way for us to simplify security audits on APCA libraries. Say APCA is allow partially trusted callers attribute.
Yeah.
These libraries marked with the allow partially trusted callers attribute, that they're the security attack area of your framework. Anything in the GAC with this allows any code that runs on that machine, whether it be from the internet, from a hostile website, or from your local machine to call into it. So this is the real security sensitive area. We introduced this concept of transparency in V2 to help us audit those more easily and make sure that we actually were putting secure libraries out there in the GAC for arbitrary code to call into. When Silverlight came along, we sort of were realizing that what we knew in V2 and we wanted to work on it, but it didn't quite meet in the V2 release. And as we started to work on Silverlight, we said, okay, we have this problem with all these granular permissions. I don't know what I can sit on top of, what I require to call all of these things. And we've got the security transparency model, which is a simpler thing, but is only used for audit. So Silverlight, what it did was it took transparency and it made it a full-out enforcement mechanism, but a much simpler one than the traditional one with tons of granular link demands and inheritance demands and all sorts of things. So now in V4, we took that a step further and we said, all right, let's take the version of transparency we evolved in Silverlight and evolve it a little bit further and make it a full-out desktop enforcement system.
Nice.
And that was the big target of what we've done in V4 for enforcement.
Mm.
Now we want to be careful because a lot of times you fall into the trap of thinking, well, permissions are just done. They're a gone concept, and that's not actually the case. Permissions as a JIT time enforcement mechanism aren't really used in V4. But permissions as a runtime enforcement mechanism are used. And it might be easier if I draw stuff out. So I should probably do a couple of seconds on what transparency is in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think that's an interesting story in the sense that Silverlight is actually, you know, helped the desktop version of this reality evolve, which is interesting.
Yeah, we knew we wanted to get here, and Silverlight gave us an interesting opportunity because we know exactly what the sandbox is, right? The desktop has interesting challenges in that it's a variety, you know, you can have any number of sandboxes. ASP.NET runs with a different sandbox than does, you know, SQL Server, then does ClickOnce, then does, you know, everyone else. And Silverlight is one, so we can very easily simplify things down. So it was a really good spot for us to take these ideas we had, implement them for the first shot and get it right, and then later take that experience and kind of expand it out to a full desktop system.
Awesome. All right.
So for transparency, the real key observation for transparency is that there's only two fundamental operations that the CLR allows, which are dangerous. Right? There's unverifiable code, and there's calling native code, like invoke, and, you know, common or opt in the same thing. If I gave you a CLR which had no ability to have unverifiable code and no ability to call native code, you could not possibly write anything dangerous with it. I would happily run every bit of code that you wrote. Now, the problem you would have is that you could not write any interesting code, right?
Yeah.
The file class couldn't exist because the file class ultimately is a p-invoke to Win32, right?
Absolutely.
And the registry class is the same thing. So, you know, I can write a really fancy calculator, but I can't ever write the result of the console or, you know, a form or anything. So obviously you need to allow these things. But what if we say you could only do these things in specifically marked, trusted areas of the code, which is what we call security critical, right? So if you're going to do any of these two things, you have to be security critical. Well, that's a good first step, which means anywhere that's doing dangerous, we now have called out with an attribute that says, hey, this is critical code, this is something you really need to look at. Mm-hmm. The next step is, all right, how do we... If all we did was put an attribute on it, it doesn't help much, right? You know, yeah, the file class is doing a p-invoke, it's got an attribute, whatever. The next thing is, if you're going to call critical code, you better be critical as well, right? Because this is doing something dangerous. Mm-hmm. We don't know for sure it's safe to expose that to you, right? So we'll say anybody that calls critical code is also now in this sensitive security kernel of the library. Mm. All right, so now we've got this section of code which can do stuff, interesting, but it can be dangerous. Mm-hmm. But it's all sectioned off, right? The only things that can call code in this group is other stuff in this group. So again, if you're writing partial trust code, you're now stuck. You can't do anything, right? So we need some way to transition between these. Mm-hmm. That's what we call the safe critical layer. So the safe critical it can do critical stuff, right? So it is critical. But it's callable by non-critical. And this non-critical code is what we call security transparent.
Interesting.
Okay. So this is transparent. So what we have now is almost like the traditional operating system, like the NT security mechanism, right? You have your user code, which transitions through, can't really do anything dangerous, it can't call protected operations, can't do kernel things, right?
Mm-hmm.
It transitions through a layer, let's call this, you know, like the NTDLL layer, and hits the kernel. And the kernel is where all the dangerous things can happen, right?
Yeah.
Well, this maps almost exactly here. This is transparent. This is safe critical. And that's critical. And so it's a simple model now. That's only one thing you're looking for. If I am partial trust code, which is transparent, I cannot call you unless you're safe critical or transparent, other transparent code. Now it's real easy. I don't have, all right, there's a link demand for unmanaged code permission. There's a link demand for, you know, skip verification. There's a link demand for all these things. I have to think, all right, do I have that? Do I not? I don't know. It's trivial now, right?
Yeah, to understand.
To figure out... It's easier to figure out if you're allowed to call something, for sure.
Absolutely.
Now, the next thing is that this transparency is all based upon attributes in your assembly. Mm-hmm. So now that means we can statically look at it, right? We can write tools that say, all right, I'm going to look at those attributes, and I'm going to look at what you're doing, and I'm going to say, oh, wait a minute. You are transparent, and you're trying to p-invoke, or you are transparent, and you're calling this critical method over here. Well, that's not going to work. And I can tell you, without actually having to run your code, if it's going to work.
Good.
Which is, the static analysis is one of my favorite parts of this. The slight twist to it is that partial trust code is all transparent. The runtime forces it to be. Obviously, you don't want it doing anything dangerous. However, it's not forced to specifically call that out with attributes. We didn't want to, I mean, it'd be a big breaking change, right? If you were ever running in a sandbox anywhere, now all of a sudden your assembly wouldn't load unless you had an attribute.
Yeah.
So we kind of put the attribute on for you, and it's one bit of dynamic state in the system that lets us not statically analyze. But if you do put the attribute on, we can do the static analysis for you. So it's sort of an opt-in pay-for-play there.
That's awesome.
So the interesting thing here, obviously, is now the state critical, because this is allowed to both do dangerous things and be called by partial, untrusted, transparent code, right?
Mm-hmm.
Transparent code may be in the platform, but it may very well be totally hostile code. And if it's in the platform, we sort of said it can't do anything dangerous, so we may not have done as thorough a security review as we would have to do for something like this, which is really the dangerous code, right?
Certainly. Now, but in the safe critical bucket, I mean, it could still be running unverifiable code.
It could be.
And
yeah.
The problem is you guys are going to have no way to reason about what that code might actually want to do.
Yeah, so safe critical, that's absolutely right. Safe critical is like the big red flag attribute. If you see safe critical anywhere, that's the hard, dangerous stuff of your code that you've got to be really sure is audited.
Yes.
Otherwise, you've got a security hole on your hands. So safe critical, one of the examples I like to use is isolated storage to sort of show how this would work. You can imagine isolated storage sitting on top of the file class, right? You know, file lets you open arbitrary files, which is dangerous, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if we imagine file having a critical open, right? And in Silverlight, it actually was critical. Sitting on top of that is isolated storage. Well, isolated storage is safer than direct file access because it makes sure that you're actually only opening files in a known location on the disk and you're not sucking up all the disk space. And it does a lot of checks, right? So this is safe critical. And then your app code comes through here. So this, the isostore layer is doing sort of complicated checks. It's saying, all right, is the app trying to open a file that is within isolated storage? If not, I reject it, right? It says, does the app use up all of its isolated storage? Well, on Silverlight, it'll prompt the user, but on the desktop, it says, nope, gone, right? And it throws it away. And only once you've passed all these checks, it's in a safe location, it's, you know, within quota, does the safe critical layer pass on to the critical layer? And now when we audit, all we have to do is look at the subcritical layer and say, okay, let's make sure that these checks are reasonable and that, you know, they're complete.
Mm-hmm.
So this is one way, and this is the way that Silverlight did it, was sort of with checks against within quotas, sort of app domain state, safe, you know, location is also app domain state. But if you're writing a desktop API, we've got, again, this interesting thing where you can have many different sandboxes, right? Some sandboxes will be allowed to open files, some won't.
True.
So let's imagine, let's just dig straight into the file API. Right, if you have file open, we'll just pseudocode this up.
Sure.
Which takes a path, right? And we'll say that this one is security safe critical. So that means partial trust code is going to call it. And then you've got a file open, takes a path. But it's security critical, so partial trust code cannot call it. And full trust unaudited code also can't call it.
Unaudited because it's not
transparent. Labeled. Yeah, it's code that we know can't do anything dangerous, so we haven't spent a lot of time looking at it. All right, so what this one can do is it can say, all right, I'm taking a path. I know you're allowed to use this file if it creates a file I/O permission. And does a demand. if this demand succeeds, so that means that all the code and all the aftermaths on the stack are allowed to open this file, then it says great, and it returns, you know, this open. This one is security critical, and it can just do the P invoke. And when we do the security audit, all we do is we say, okay, this one's critical. Nobody on Trusted can call it. Everyone who calls it has to have either been audited because they're safe critical or, you know, critical themselves, so that it just calls through and trusts that this path is good. That's fine. Mm-hmm. This one's safe critical. Partial trust code can call it, so it better make sure it's good to open that path. Ah, well, we're back to our old friend permissions. It does a permission demand for that path, so it's reasonable. Mm. And this is sort of the role of permissions in the new security model. It's not for link time checks. Link time checks are done by this critical, safe critical mechanism by the JIT. It's much more for, is the aftermain, is the code I'm running on right now allowed to perform an operation? It's for these dialable APIs, right? You'll have something like file open that doesn't check anything, which is never callable by partial trust. And you'll have something like maybe some of the math functions, the square root or whatever, are implemented as unverifiable code, maybe, just for performance reasons. Mm. But it's never dangerous to call square root, right? So those are always safe critical and are always available no matter what the sandbox. But then you've got these, the file open sub the world, which some sandboxes allow, some sandboxes don't, and that's where the permission demands come back into play.
Excellent. So now I guess one question I would ask, I mean, in the real world, dynamic languages are sort of the excellent thing du jour, and we have the DLR and all that stuff.
Right.
Now, you know, you can imagine that code is being executed at runtime, and you know, maybe you're like, so I have two questions. I have, how does the dynamic world impact this, or how does this impact the dynamic world? And secondly, what if I'm, you know, a developer that's writing, give me code and I execute it on the fly, right? Give me source code and I'm going to compile it on the fly. And how does this work?
Okay. So there's
it's a hard
sort of
problem.
Two separate, yeah, there it is. We've worked actually pretty close with the DLR guys. I know you've probably talked with Martin over there.
I think so. Yeah. The guy who wrote the sample, famous sample language. Absolutely.
Yes, so yeah, Martin and I have worked pretty closely together about getting the DLR to work with this. One of the nice things with the DLR is they're emitting code on a fly, right? Which is kind of a scary thing. You have to make sure you've got that code correct. Well, if they emit transparent code, even if they didn't get it right, it can't do anything dangerous, right?
Excellent.
But also, now we're back in that category of it also can't do anything interesting. So we've got this concept, which is, now you want to dive deep. There's actually two types of transparency in the system. There's level one and level two. And, you know, with the thinking that potentially there might be a level three and V5 or V6 in the runtime or whatever.
Sure.
So there's, you know, so there's level one and level two. Level one is, you know, sort of the V2.0 world. Now, level two is going to be the default, but you can opt back into level one if you want to. And the key distinction between these two is that in level two, transparency errors are what I like to call hard failures. When I explain this to, for instance, to the DLR team, these are hard failures. If I violate one of the transparency rules, if I try to have unverifiable code, or if I transparent code can't satisfy a link demand, for instance, if there's still a link demand method, what we do is we convert that to a permission demand. And if the stack is fully trusted, then we let it, or sorry, this hard errors, what we do is we just fail right there, right? You cannot possibly do that. In level one, there's soft errors, and this is what I was just saying. If you violate one of these rules, we convert it to a permission demand. And we say, all right, if the stack is fully trusted, even though you're transparent, you try to use unverifiable code, which is technically a violation of the transparency rules, the stack is trusted, so we'll allow you to do that. So this is the mode that the DLR runs in. And what it basically means is, if they're running fully trusted, if you're running, you know, a Python script that you wrote, you trust it, you just want it to run, great, it's in full trust, everything works. Now, if you're an ASP.NET and you're running a Python script from an untrusted, you know, location in medium trust, well, now things start to fail, which is sort of what you would want, right? The partial trust code, there cannot be a bug in the DLR as long as they're emitting transparent code that leads to the security escalation, because the runtime is saying, well, you emitted code that you said you don't trust, so we're going to take care of checking that it's doing correct things for you.
Excellent. Good.
Yeah. And you can imagine the same thing with the code that you're loading. If you load it into partial trust, again, we're going to force it to be transparent, and if you don't trust it, then it's not going to work.
Awesome. I mean, again, this is great. I mean, simplifying security is good.
It's good. We're not all the way there, but I think we've made a lot of steps in the right direction with this release. There's more. Security is always complicated when you get into the nitty-gritty details of it, for sure. We're just trying to make it more accessible and easier to write secure libraries.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, you know, the CLR is in the business of general-purpose computing, right? Yeah. You don't really have any concept of what people are going to do,
exactly. Right?
You're just going to run it. That's your job. You run.
Yep.
You run code, man.
We do.
That's awesome. Cool.
Yeah, one of the nice things we did with level 2 is that you allow partially trusted callers attribute. These libraries that I said were the dangerous ones. As soon as you put APCA on your assembly, that means all your code is transparent.
Hmm.
So, if you identified your assembly as being dangerous, by default, none of it can do dangerous things. You now have to go back through and say, okay, this is the specific area of code that I want to be critical and safe critical, and make sure that you're auditing that. Rather than in previous releases, you put on APCA and all your code could be dangerous.
Mm.
Now we're saying, no, none of it's dangerous until you put some of it back in the dangerous bucket.
Mm.
And then similarly, if you don't put anything, you're all critical, which means if your library says nothing about, well, I don't know about security, I don't understand security, here is a full trust library that I just want, it's a math library and I want to expose it out to, you know, full trust callers. It's great, it'll work for full trust callers because they'll all be critical as well, and no one partial trust can call it because of the same transparency rules. There's no more, there used to be an arbitrary distinction between signed assemblies and, you know, unsigned assemblies. It was confusing, it was arbitrary, we sort of got rid of that. We said, no, it doesn't make sense. If you know about security, you're going to be all safe by default until you put some back in the unsafe bucket. And if you don't know about security, you're going to be completely unavailable to partial trust code, which is what it should be, right? You don't want someone who specifically doesn't want to have their code, you know, used by partial trust, having partial trust in because they happen to not sign it.
Mm. Excellent. And so for the, you know, the legion of .NET developers out there today who have been working with this sort of complex, hard-to-navigate model, maybe they've developed some bad habits along the way. You know, are there going to be tools available that I can analyze my code?
Yeah, that's what I was talking about. The nice benefit is the static analysis, which means that we can write tools that can look at your assembly and say, hey, yeah, you're doing this and that's not going to work, or you're doing, you know, this other thing over here and that's dangerous. You should not be doing that.
Excellent.
And what's even better is that we can use, we sort of have this kernel of rules that we use internally for things like MSCoreLib and, you know, system.core.dll, system security DLL, you know, framework assemblies. We've sort of adopted this kernel of rules and are going to build both a tool that can analyze your assembly and sort of say, oh, you know, you're writing a partial trust assembly and you're violating a rule over here. You better go mark it up and say this is critical, this is safe critical. And also can build fxcop rules out of that. So when you finish your assembly, you can just run fxcop over it, and it'll say, wait a minute, you're partially trusted, or you want to be partially trusted, and you're calling, you know, this critical API that's not going to work at runtime.
Excellent, man.
So it's always nice to move runtime errors back into design time to catch them earlier.
Amen.
Yeah.
Nice job, dude. So how long have you been on the CLR team anyway?
I interned on it in the pre-V1.0 days.
Nice.
I was an intern. And then I came back just after they shipped 1.0, working on 1.1. So that was 2003, I guess. It's been 6 years now.
Yeah.
Yeah, I missed the legendary Vegas ship party.
Oh,
for
man.
V1.0. I left just in the wrong window of time.
Yeah. Oh, man. And so have you always been working on security?
I have. I've been, I'm now officially the longest tenured security person on the CLR. Yeah.
Nice, man.
Yep.
Well, cool. I love the sort of the pattern of simplicity.
Yeah, definitely. We're trying to make sure that by default it's as easy as it can be. And that's sort of my goal personally for this release and going forward.
Of course, you know, developers can still write bad code.
They can. we try to make it harder to do so. And that's, again, going back to the APCA makes it all transparent. You can write bad code, but you sort of have to work a little harder now to make it bad and insecure.
Excellent, man. Well, hey, great job.
Great, thanks.
And thanks for coming on Channel 9.
Great.
Good to meet you, man.
Yeah, let's see.